Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, if Republicans don't agree to give the Democrats' early presidential primary immediate effect, the legislature would need to adjourn by September 1st to make the mechanics work for an election, says Peter Rudell of the Honigman Law Firm. Rudell and the baldly bipartisan crew of Adrian Hemond of Grassroots Midwest and John Selleck of Harbor Strategic talk about the associated legal and political challenges. And a potential challenge to the income tax rollback, 7th Congressional District possibilities, and Senator Darren Camilleri talks about why trains are blocking roads in his district for hours a week. All in this week's show. Now here's MERS editor Kyle Malin.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore. Michigan's legislature is in a position where it may need to adjourn session earlier than Christmas, as has become custom since the 1960s, due to a pair of timing issues. The Democrats passed the bill to create a February 27 presidential primary to fit in with the Democrats' new schedule. That doesn't work for the Republicans' schedule. If the presidential primary for the Republicans are held on February 27 in Michigan, Michigan would lose 80% of its delegates, which is something they don't want. So the Republicans in the legislature have denied giving this bill immediate effect. What that means is that this bill now only takes effect 90 days after the legislature adjourns for the year. Thus, if they wait until Christmas, that ain't going to work. So they got to move that up unless they can strike a deal with Republicans to go back and give that bill or give the substance of that bill immediate effect. There's also an issue with the budget. Up until now, the Republicans have said no to everything that the Democrats have put forward on their budget for negotiating purposes and for leverage. But would it be to their advantage to, again, say no on the budget, not give the budget immediate effect, and then, again, force the legislature to adjourn early prior to July 4th, the 4th of July holiday, in order for it to take effect immediately? We're going to talk about this issue with a few people. We're going to start with Peter Rudell, attorney here with Honigman, who's going to give us his thoughts on it. And Peter, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Let's get your take here on this immediate effect issue from a legal front.
So there's been a lot of chatter about what a special session could look like, what powers there are. First and foremost, right, I think, you know, it is an abrogation of the legislature's duty to adjourn early, with the idea that they would allow the governor to call them back for whatever reason. Right? I think the legislature really abrogates their duty to the governor at that point. So I think that would be a mistake, no matter whose party is in control. But if the governor were to call them back in special session, the Constitution is really vague, and it gives the governor opportunities to not just call them back for one item at a time, but a whole series of items, right? So there is an opportunity for them to essentially have a special session that is broad in its nature and allows the legislature to function as if it were in a general session.
So if the governor has these broad powers, she could negotiate with the legislature beforehand and they could agree upon, governor, call us back for this, that, and the other thing, and make it broad items, and they could basically take up whatever they wanted.
It could. Yeah, you're absolutely right. But then you've ceded away your power and control to the governor, right? Sure, there is a broad set of parameters by which she could call you back, but you are still at her mercy to determine if you are called back, when you are called back. And I think it is a complete abrogation of the legislature's responsibility as a co-equal branch of government.
You know, I just want to drop that the last time there was a special session of this nature in Michigan was in the late 1960s with Governor George Romney, and it was over housing, civil rights, and judicial funding. Now, you know, I guess I can't help but wonder that depending on if this special session theory comes to fruition, it kind of reminds me of the Emergency Powers Act during COVID. You know, can someone say the governor is using this constitutional tool too excessively?
I don't see that argument here, right? If the legislature has chosen to adjourn sine die, the legislature has taken their action, and then they've given the governor the ability to call them back into special session. So I don't see in our Republican form of government that we really have that same argument that could be made here.
Before you'd even adjourn, don't you think, I mean, if you were the speaker, same party of so the governor, don't you think you'd have a lot of demands before you would have to, you know, just adjourn?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think you would put together all of the parameters by which you would meet and be willing to meet. I would also think mm-hmm. that there are probably actions that you would want the executive branch to take that they have been holding on, whatever that may mean, right? Some type of rule promulgation, some type of enforcement action, some type of permit approval that they have been sitting on. I think there's a whole lot of leverage that the legislature could pursue if they wanted to provide the governor with this extraordinary power.
Seems to me with this conversation that maybe Republicans should be more acceptable to Democrats' budget ideas, because if they, you know, give them a reason to do an early signy die, they're handing over their legislative power authority to kick off session to the governor.
Yeah, yeah, in some respects. Let's take the presidential primary and put that aside for a minute. But, you know, my guess is that they come to an accommodation on the budget, right? I mean, I just think that the Republicans will negotiate, and the Democrats have indicated a willingness to negotiate. So I think if you're talking about immediate effect, I think we're really almost laser focused on the Democratic presidential primary bill as the only issue that's really in debate here. I think the budget will get immediate effect. I think there will be a negotiation to get to that point.
When would the legislature have to adjourn in order for the early presidential primary bill to take effect?
So I did the math months ago. So this is got some cobwebs on it, but it is roughly September 1st.
September 1st?
September 1st, right?
Now why?
Because you have to have the opportunity for the Secretary of State to do all of the preparations necessary to print the ballots, to make the military ballots available overseas, to do everything that is necessary for the ballot making process starts much sooner than whatever it is, February 24th, February 21st, whatever the date is. So they can't wait until October, November. If you start to do the clock, right, you've got to add 90 days to whenever that adjournment is, and then you've got to add essentially somewhere between 60 and 75 days from that point in order to make sure the bill is effective in order for all of those actions to occur. So again, it's a little foggy. I did this math a while ago, but roughly September 1st.
When do the Republicans then have to notify the Secretary of State as to when they want to hold their presidential selection process, whether it's on that date or something else?
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head. I'd have to reread the statute on that.
Okay. But it wouldn't necessarily need to be September 1st, would it?
No, it would not necessarily need to be September 1st. Right, I mean, you got a lot of assumptions going on here.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Right? Yeah, I know. Right. But that's what we like to do on this podcast, you know.
So is if your assumption is that the February date is going to be the controlling date, when the presidential primary caucus, whatever we're going to call it, is going to occur, then I think that the Republicans do have to tell the Secretary of State probably in the 6 month mark in advance. But that's a dart at a board, not having reviewed the statute in a long, long time.
So it's fair to say that it's earlier than January 1.
Correct.
From my read, then, it doesn't really matter if they adjourn before July 1 or September 1, because they weren't going to do anything anyway on their calendar. The month of July and August is basically free of any kind of legislative activity unless they want to do something. So it really doesn't matter. They might as well just adjourn July 1 if they can't come to an agreement on the presidential primary.
And let's not forget about these two candidates running for mayoral race, right? These two Democrats who probably don't want to be in Lansing between July 1st and the 1st of August in any event, right? Presuming that they, right? I mean, I think Lori Stone got a big bump by the Supreme Court with Fouts not being a candidate. So now you've got these two candidates who really need to be out campaigning. So I totally agree.
So the Democrats are not going to have them at their disposal necessarily. They can't count on them. So that's two votes, and that there goes their majority right there.
Correct.
So they may adjourn sine die at the end of June anyway.
Right. You're continuing to make the assumption that they're not going to get to deal with the Republicans on immediate effect on the budget, which I think they do.
Right.
And that the presidential primary remains a motivating factor. If Joe Biden is the only candidate, well, forgive me, Bobby Kennedy Jr., right? You've got two Democratic candidates.
Well, and Marianne Williamson, too.
Three Democratic candidates, right? What is the motivation for the Democrats to have a primary in 24?
Because they want to set the groundwork, apparently, for more primaries in the future.
Right. But this will be the primary in 2028, right?
Yes.
What is the motivation for the Democrats to have a primary if the incumbent president is running for re-election?
Now, my understanding on this from talking with Congresswoman Debbie Dingell is that they just want to get this set up so that Michigan will be an early primary state going forward, whether it's 28 or 32 or 36.
Right. And
yeah, it'll be in effect, right, for 28.
Law,
right?
Law will be in effect. Now you're looking at the DNC rules, right? Do the DNC rules change, right? But our law will be in effect.
Let's change the subject here. What are the Republicans' legal remedies if they want to challenge the Attorney General's opinion that this income tax rollback is more than 1 year, that it is in fact permanent, that this law that was created in 2015 that allowed the income tax to roll back if the economy hit certain metrics is not a one-time deal? You've taken a look at this. What is your opinion if the Republicans want to make this change from 4.25% to 4.05% permanent?
So I don't think the Attorney General's opinion is necessarily wrong or invalid, but it is a gray area, right? And her opinion, I think, hones in on what the issue is. What does the term current rate mean? Under the Attorney General's opinion, the current rate is and forever will be 4.25%. What the Republican legislature, at least, that adopted this, would argue that the current rate decreases down to 4.05 this year, and then that is the new current rate. And there is no opportunity for this mechanism to cause an income tax rate to go back up to 4.25. It is forever down to 4.05, and when the circumstances are ripe, it could decrease again in the future. So that's the issue in a nutshell.
Do the Republican caucuses in the Senate and the House, do they have anything in their toolbox to take legal action to say, hey, this is a permanent income tax rollback, and this is why it needs to maintain this way?
So the toolbox is not yet available to them, right? There is no case or controversy for them to litigate. You'd have to think about when is the next opportunity for them to litigate. They can't litigate over any attorney general opinion. You'd look at the point in time, maybe late 2023, when the treasurer or Department of Treasury issues a bulletin that says, effective January 1, the income tax rate is 4.25%. So start your withholding effective January 1 at that rate. Or potentially the second week in January when the revenue estimating conference occurs in 2024, and they come back and do the calculation that is required under this section of law and says the new tax rate should be X, taking this provision into account. Or at what point in time do people start paying their taxes? And that's the first case in controversy. So there's got to be some other government action beyond just this attorney general's opinion for which I think the legislature, and frankly, I don't think it's going to be the legislature that files a suit. I think it's going to be a private individual who is forced to pay the increased tax rate.
Once there is a cause of action, though, I mean, this litigation is going to follow a pretty standard course, right? I mean, it's going to wind up in front of a Democratic-controlled Supreme Court. Am I wrong?
It's going to start in front of a court of claims judge, right? Whoever that may be, as we've got a court of claims statute that's moving its way through the legislature to change that. But yes, it could conceivably end up before the Michigan Supreme Court.
Is it a coin flip as to whether the Supreme Court would agree with the Republicans?
I think it is. First and foremost, right, we don't know what the breadth of arguments that are going to be made on this. You know, I think it was intentional by the Attorney General to make a fairly short opinion on this. And I think it was intentional of the Attorney General not to address the non-delegation doctrine on this as well. So this is an indefinite period of time. I think, if you were to reread in the certified question, the case involving all the COVID orders, you could make an argument that this was an unconstitutional delegation of legislative prerogative to the executive to determine the tax rate. So there is an argument there as well. So I think there's a whole series of arguments that could be made for and against this that have not yet fully developed.
Could you explain that the non-delegation doctrine, is that what you mean?
Yeah.
That the executive took powers that should have come from the legislature when she enacted these orders for COVID. Is that what you're saying?
So that is what the Supreme Court determined back in October of 20, if I've got my 21, whatever year that occurred. Right. Who has the authority to set the tax rate in the state of Michigan? Is it a calculation that can be made by the state treasurer and the unelected directors of the Senate and House Fiscal Agency? Or is that properly a function of the legislative branch, and only the legislative branch, through the enactment process of a bill and a law that can make that determination? So that's in my mind the essence of the question. So I think this is something that, you know, could be part of a litigation strategy. If I were defending that this particular provision, this mechanism that causes it to decrease, is unconstitutional.
One last subject here, Peter. It seems like this governor has really stretched the bounds, or really pushed the bounds, of her authority as the chief executive. Is that a fair way to look at this?
Well, you know, if you look back to, 2019, September, August, whatever the time frame was, when she used the administrative board to make all of those transfers, I think this governor is prepared to use everything at her disposal in order to advance her policy agenda. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but she's taken steps that, right, John Engler probably wouldn't have taken when he was the governor. So she's used the power that's afforded to her, and it's all legal and in accordance with the Constitution, but she has looked to use her power to advance her policy agenda, and I think she should be, you know, in some respects, applauded for being creative at the way that she has looked at her power and used it through the state constitution and the laws that have been afforded to her.
Was she overly creative during COVID?
So here's the frustration with in my mind with COVID, right? Is if you go back, I don't know, maybe in the first iteration of COVID, there was a gentleman down in Metro Detroit who was building a house, and he had his local inspector tell him that he could not put a roof on the house in the springtime because the governor's orders only said he could use temporary measures. So that meant he had to put a tarp over his house when snow, rain, everything else was imminent for an extended period of time. And you know, there was no clarity coming from anywhere on that particular subject. So he was forced to file a suit on that case. And if you remember, right, it was in a Sunday front page story in one of the Detroit newspapers. And immediately the governor said, of course you can put a roof on your house if you're building a house. This is not intended to do anything of the sort of just making it a tarp. And so there was so much confusion, and the executive office was governing by infographics and FAQs. And I think that is a really bad way in which the people should be governed, by a communications director changing an infographic. So if I were to offer a criticism of the administration, which I've said before, it's that they needed to be consistent, and they needed to have a better job of providing notice to their changes and an opportunity for people to understand what the changes were, not simply an infographic.
Is there an easy way to explain sort of how the governor's powers will look different in the next pandemic vis-a-vis the legal challenges or losses she sustained?
I think at the end of the day, the executive branch lost very little power. Right. So the Department of Health and Human Services still has all of the power that was exercised post October 2020 that they utilized and exercised. So I think the executive branch as a whole, really, you're not going to see a dramatic change in the next pandemic. Should there be one? Of course, there will be. You know, the extraordinary measures on pausing unemployment and pausing some of those other items that the governor did through this particular mechanism. She also had the other act that was at her disposal, which required a concurrence of the legislature. So remember, that act is still in effect. So I think the governor's powers overall probably are not dramatically diminished as a result of either the lawsuit or the initiated law.
She will have to negotiate with the legislature next time that she wants to extend an executive order past, what is it, 28 days?
Sam,
John, anything else? Okay. Peter?
No, I'm disappointed we didn't talk about Coach Kyle, the superstar in our household.
we can bring in Justice Clement, and we can talk about cross country and track too. That'd be fun. Thank you very much, Peter Riddell from the Hondman Firm. Appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Hey, my pleasure.
All right, joining us back on the podcast is the BaldlyBipartisan.com crew of John Selleck and Adrian Heeman, who have been on the road giving their takes to various different outfits and agencies and corporations and groups and whatever. They bring these guys in to share their commentary. They've been friends of this podcast for quite a while, and we appreciate bringing them back in here to talk about the perspective of the legislature actually adjourning early this year due to some timing issues. Appreciate you both coming in here. And Adrian, I want to start with you. Do you believe that the legislature actually will adjourn early this year, sine die?
I think it's entirely possible. It's hard to say right now, right? There are, the one thing that's hanging out there that everyone has talked about is the presidential primary and moving that date forward for the state of Michigan. You know, it, for that to happen, it you know, they would need to adjourn sine die pretty early, you know, like early fall in order to make that happen. There's also been some speculation that if they can't work out a deal on immediate effect for the budget, they could adjourn really, really early. So it's there's certainly a non-zero chance. I'd put it like, you know, maybe one chance in four that it actually happens. There's still quite a bit of runway left for them to work out deals on either or both of those things. I think the budget, it's pretty likely that they work a deal out on. And then, you know, TBD as far as the presidential primary. Some of that depends on whether the Republicans want to make a deal and whether Republicans are intending to have their own primary or whether they're going to do a closed caucus or something like that to select who gets Michigan's delegates.
And that's the question. Do the Republicans have an incentive to make a deal, A, on the budget, John, and B, on the presidential primary bill?
Well, I don't think they have any real reason to make a deal on the presidential primary bill, and I actually question the importance of it anymore. President Biden seems to be right on track to do what he needs to do. It's more of a glamour thing for Michigan, and that's a lot of hoops to jump through to get a glamour thing for Michigan. That doesn't really matter to anybody in the public's eye. Look, you know, the governor's campaign, all through her television advertising last year, the undercurrent was competence. Those folks over in the MAGA world, incompetent, chaos, me, you know, I balance budgets and I don't raise taxes and I get things done. That was the tagline at the end of every ad. So to enter in this into this uncharted territory of adjourning session and holding special sessions and having to operate on what would amount to a high wire act for her seems to carry a whole lot of risk for no good reason. So there's probably some areas where they could cut some deals, like it's not just road funding the Republicans keep talking about, it's local road funding. Who is the first person that gets to go and stand at the press conference or the orange barrels when there's a local road project? It's the governor.
Is.
Yeah. So I think she'd come out fine on that kind of deal.
Adrian, going back to you then. So if the governor agrees to with the Republican legislature on a budget, but they still want to do this presidential primary because they want to set the stage for the year's outward, not just 2024, where Biden would appear to be the nominee again, but 2028, when Governor Whitmer herself might be a nominee. You want to start setting that precedent of having that presidential primary in February. But if the Republicans aren't playing ball, it does complicate things quite a bit.
Yeah, it certainly does. And John's right that there's some downside risk here. I think the most important piece of downside risk is that, you know, adjourning the legislature early for the purposes of partisan presidential primary politics is a bad look, right? Just to most members of the general public who don't live in the sort of political bubble, that's a bad look. It's a worse look if it's irrelevant, right? If President Biden is indeed running for re-election, which it appears that he is, then it's not only nakedly political, but it's pretty irrelevant this time. And to your point, Kyle, it would certainly be spun by Republicans to the greater public as Governor Whitmer and the legislative Democrats trying to play games to set her up to run for president in 2028. So I'm still somewhat skeptical that they would get to the point of adjourning early, especially because with Republicans being, you know, out of power completely in state government right now, there are lots of things that they want. And so there is some opportunity for deal making there to try and get some of that done, even if it's deal making that's not specifically related to the presidential primary for the Democrats. There's all kinds of things that Republicans want that they have absolutely no power to effectuate right now. And if the governor and legislative Democrats are willing to give them some crumbs, they can probably get this without having to adjourn early.
Which would be easily counted as a victory for Eric Nesbitt and Matt Hall. Any kind of change in this where they say, okay, we've struck a deal and we've arranged to get X or Y, will be perceived as an advantage. I mean, Eric Nesbitt is a party builder, so he's looking not only at the Senate down the road in the future, but he's looking at bringing a House majority along 2 years from now. That'll make his life a whole lot easier. Matt Hall is a very aggressive tactician. They're willing to cut deals, but first they're going to hold. They're going to try to at least appear they're holding the governor and the Democrats' feet to the fire. Personally, I think the governor already reached her personal signee die with the legislature. That giant wave of legislation that came through in the first couple of months here has allowed her to essentially tour the national media and say, look what I did. I got the keys to a purple state. I passed a progressive slash kitchen table agenda, and it all looks like it's working out great. She hasn't even had to really unpack what's inside of it in too much detail. She just wants to pass this budget and be done with this. That's her personal signee die. I think if I'm the Speaker Tate, if I'm Senate Majority Leader Brinks, why do I want to give up my power and hand it over to the governor for setting the agenda going forward? It would be completely taken from their hands. And I can actually see a scenario where it backfires on the Democrats because some of the split we've already heard so much about within the House caucus. If you were not in charge right now, you might want to say, hey, look, the folks in charge gave away all our power. We are all activists. We became legislators to make change. And now they've given away that power to the governor. It seems like we would think, well, this is the same party, but it doesn't matter. It's still about the power and the ability to move bills.
I wanted to touch on the runway argument you made earlier, Adrian. And what I was thinking about when we talked to our earlier guest, Peter Riddell, is that if they don't come to an agreement on the budget, do they still have to adjourn early signing day anyway because of how the calendar works out? And just listen to me on this, that the calendar, if Peter Riddell's right, and if they don't come to a deal on the presidential primary, he said they have to adjourn by September 1 in order for that presidential primary to actually happen in late February. So if the calendar already has them off July and August, what difference does it make if they adjourn at the end of June or September 1?
Well, it depends on if there are things that the governor and or legislative Democrats want to get accomplished, right, during that period of time. And the scenario you laid out all presupposes that no deal gets cut over immediate effect for the presidential primary.
Oh,
which
and they
is
could do
still
that
a possibility.
In June. Yeah. So we got to see if that happens in June or not.
That's right. Yeah. And so it's sort of dependent on that. And there is plenty of runway yet to cut that deal, right? If they would have to adjourn by September 1st in order to effectuate the presidential primary, I mean, it's still May right now. That gives them, you know, a few months to try and cut a deal on that. The other thing, circling back to what John said, I mean, I think he correctly identified some of the downside risk for Democrats here. There's downside risk for Republicans, too. By which I mean legislative Republicans right now don't have much control of the agenda, but they do, meet and speak with legislative Democrats basically every day that they're in session. And they have an opportunity to negotiate with them over what's going to come up on the agenda the next day or next week or 2 weeks from now. If the legislature adjourns, that power is all ceded to the governor. That's a downside risk for legislative Democrats, but it's a downside risk for legislative Republicans as well, especially legislative Republicans who are not named Eric Nesbitt and Matt Hall. Those two have the advantage that the governor knows who they are. The rest of those people, the governor does not. I assure you, she does not know those people, and they have zero power to negotiate what comes up on the agenda. The governor will still take Matt Hall and Eric Nesbitt's calls if they adjourn early, but that's not true for the rest of those Republican caucuses.
I want to get your reaction to that. It seems to me that on the balance for both sides, there's more risk to sort of going this early adjournment route for both parties. Is that fair?
Yes, I think this is, you know, and look, to some extent, this is how we do politics now, not just in Michigan, but nationally, right? Which is, rather than the two parties negotiating with one another or being seen by the most rabid activists in their parties being seen negotiating with one another, they look for procedural gimmicks to try and get the job done. And that's what this would be. I don't think either party comes off very well if that's what actually ends up happening.
I agree with Adrian, and I've only agreed with you once openly. You agreed with me twice, so I got to catch up here. I'm working on that. We know that our good friends like Adrian will do very well if there's some kind of alteration to the system, because in particular, if you want to play chicken with the Republicans over something, it's over the school aid budget, in my estimation, because it's not just, oh, we're not standing by our kids. It's, I don't have any place to take my kids when September 1 rolls around. You get really frustrated at that point. Like, I can't even take my kids to school or back to the pandemic time again. That's a huge problem for families. And where what helps my friends like Adrian is that suddenly somebody like the MEA is like, I like this. I'm going to be pounding individual House members' districts with calls, texts, protests. I'm going to be doing advertising in their districts. I'm going to be doing billboards, all kinds of stuff to really put them through the ringer. And during that game of chicken is what's fraught, I think, with the most danger overall.
But John, I wanted to mention this about the budget. The governor looks good once this budget gets signed, doesn't she? I mean, it's just a ton of money. The spending is going to be basically what she asked for. She's going to look great when this thing is signed, regardless.
She does. Even if she suddenly had to like whack a priority of somebody in her caucus to shove whatever the agreed to amount of acceptable dollars went to like local roads or whatever it is the Republicans are calling for. Yeah, she's going to look awesome. She's riding high. I mean, we haven't seen a governor doing this well, running this many points ahead of both the sitting and ex-presidents. I mean, it's hard to pick apart anything she's doing wrong at this point. And to me, she looks at the legislature and says, wow, it went unbelievably well the first couple months of this year. I need to get the hell out of here. I'm going to go out and do my own thing and let them do that. If she has to take control of the situation, she is suddenly on the news every night. And with razor thin majorities and all that stuff, that puts a lot of pressure on her. She'd much rather cut a deal. Frankly, I think they'd much rather even change the rules in the Senate, regardless of the perceived Irwin problem, and make it match the House. They can at least make that argument on immediate effect than to have to go to this, you know, shutdown and or special session route.
All right, I'm going to change subjects here. A couple weeks ago, Alyssa Slotkin's U.S. Senate campaign came out with its endorsement list of mid-Michigan supporters. Three names on there that were not on there: Barb Byram, the Ingham County Clerk, former Senator Curtis Hertel, and State Senator Sam Singh were not on that list. What should we read into that, Adrian?
I mean, I wouldn't read much into it. I mean, certainly each of those three individuals merits their own rollout for an endorsement. At a minimum, their own social media post and a fundraising email to their donor list, because each of those three individuals has been quite good at raising money in the past. So I wouldn't read much into this other than the Slotkin campaign holding their fire to maximize every possible dollar that they can wring out of the donor lists of those three individuals.
I was going conspiratorial route, John. So let me tell you my theory here. All three of these people have not taken their name out of running for Congress, succeeding Slotkin in that Michigan 7th congressional district. Curtis Hertel is in a situation where he works for the governor, cannot endorse really openly anyway because he's a government employee at this point. So out of deference to him, she isn't going to include other names of other people who have not taken themselves out of consideration, Barb Byram, and really Sam Singh has not taken his name out either. So she's not going to include any of the three. What do you think of this conspiracy theory?
I love your conspiracy theory.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
I am also sitting here with you, so I have to actually look you in the eye. I think you're right. There is an element of that. It's no different than with the Senate seat itself when it came open. This just does not happen very often. It's like, here is a seat that we should be able to win. A lot of people kick the tires for a long time. The first person that comes to my mind on the Senate side that took a long time to say no was Debbie Dingell. And you're like, wait, she doesn't need to do that. She's already accomplished so much. But she's like, it's a U.S. Senate seat. I want to think about this a little longer. Jocelyn Benson did the same thing, right? I also kind of wonder, and maybe Adrian can talk to this, there doesn't necessarily seem to be the same Debbie Stabenow controlling behind the scenes factor within this congressional seat as there was with the Senate seat. And there's obvious differences there we don't have to go into, but it's hard to tell, like, who is the person actually helping make it so neat and clean and tie it in a bow like they did with the Senate primary thus far. That doesn't seem to be there. I also think there's an element of what Adrian said is true. There's two times I said you're right, that there's not a whole lot going on in the U.S. Senate race right now. Like, the real downside I felt all along of Slack and getting in to fulfill this opportunity to wipe everybody else out of the primary before it got rolling is that you have to sit out there on stage for like almost 2 years by the time the election gets here. That's a long time. So once the thrill and the excitement of doing the statewide media tour is over, and then sadly, but still, it provided a lot of grist for the mill. The MSU shooting had Alyssa Slotkin standing in front of the Capitol getting loud cheers from the crowd. That's now passed. So now it's down to the sitting around the table looking at your fellow staff people like, could we put out let's do an endorsement one. Let's do an endorsement press release. And that's what's happening here as well.
I was going to say, as far as primary challenges to Slotkin, if they're going to happen, what do you think the timeline is that another candidate has to jump in with some money?
It depends how big a check they're going to write, right? Like, if you're not going to write yourself a check for a seven-figure sum, then you needed to announce several weeks ago. If you are, then we can play around with the timeline a little bit. But Congresswoman Slotkin has a massive fundraising lead already, for that primary election. If you're going to get into that on the Democratic side, you know, you better be prepared to stroke yourself a seven-figure check for that campaign to get caught up. If you are, then you could probably wait as much as like 6 to 8 weeks from now, to actually set up the infrastructure of a campaign before you announce. But if you don't have that kind of money, find something else to do with your time.
The most likely Democratic candidate in the 7th Congressional District is Adrian.
Boy, that's an open question right now. You mentioned three names that have not taken themselves out of consideration. I think any of the three of them would potentially be a strong candidate, but they don't seem to be beating down the doors in the same way that Congresswoman Slotkin was to get into that U.S. Senate race. I think part of the reason for that is that, you know, the campaign arm of the National Congressional Democrats, the DCCC, they have been trying to recruit in this seat, and some of the other folks that they've approached have told them no. And so I think that there's going to be a sort of feeling out process here. And I would imagine, if it hasn't happened already, that probably the DCCC is going to do some polling in this district in the not too distant future to determine who's got the best shot to take this seat. Recall, this is a very, very closely drawn seat. It was the most expensive congressional seat in the country last cycle. And you need to have a high quality candidate that can come roaring out of the gate and raise money. I think that potentially applies to any of those three, Barb Byram, Curtis Hertel Jr., and Sam Singh. But it's, I think part of what is making that process slower is that this is actually awful work that you would be taking on yourself, right? Running for a competitive congressional seat, you are a professional fundraiser. If you are not calling strangers for 8 hours per day and asking them for their money, you're going to lose. That's really unpleasant work. And your prize for that is that you get to go to Washington, D.C. for 2 years and do exactly the same thing. You will move no legislation. Your voice will not to about anything. If you try to speak up, somebody's going to grab you by the collar and say, get back in that basement and make more phone calls. That's not the most appealing prospect, particularly for those three, all of whom have, have families, still have children at home. It's a tough sell.
You know, and thinking of families, the political families, I mean, the Democrats have a huge advantage here that they have a deep bench. There's a lot of people. Angela Whitworth would be a fantastic candidate. Sarah Anthony would be a fantastic candidate, let alone Curtis, Barb, and Sam. But they are also deeply intertwined, not only in the Ann County Democratic world, the state party Democratic world, and the legislature. If two of them ran against each other for some reason, they'd be putting a whole lot of friends in awkward places, having to pick sides, having to sign endorsement sheets, having to decide who to give money to or give them all money. It'd be really, really difficult. And so I'm not surprised to see Sam's name start to pop up. He could be in his seat for quite a while and enjoy it, but like, no one's taken it. It seems that maybe Barb Byram, who to me seemed like the obvious initial candidate, thought, I want to be Secretary of State. I want to be able to run for clerk again and have that future. And if I run for Congress, I won't have that option. Or to just look at Curtis, who has all the connections in the world, is a really great strategist, is super aggressive. He's apparently running against another white dude. So that kind of helps him on that front too.
Well, the interesting thing is, if you're talking about, if your interest is public policy, it's almost all those candidates, almost all of them have a better public policy role right now than they would, like Adrian pointed out, if they went to DC.
That's right.
Well, we'll see how that one plays out there. I was hoping that you guys would give me names, but that's okay. We can.
I don't know. I think Kyle Malin and John Roering both live in the district. I mean, you have name ID, awareness,
yeah, right.
Fundraising connections.
Yeah, you bet. You bet. I think
again, if your interest is public policy, we have better roles right now.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Well played.
All right. Well, thank you, Adrian Heeman and John Selleck. Again, they are part of the baldlybipartisan.com crew, and you can check them out on that website if you want to bring them to your next convention. And if you want to bring me along too, I'm always available as well.
We have a great time with you, Kyle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're going to do Traverse City Connect, I think, this year again, right?
Yep.
Yeah, right. So we'll look forward to that. All right. Thanks, guys. We'll see you again soon.
All right. See ya.
Okay, so here today we have Senator Darren Camilleri, the chair of the pre-K through 12 Senate Appropriations Budget Subcommittee, and also who finally got his legislation passed in the Senate chamber dealing with rail grade separation, especially an issue that affects his community quite significantly. How are you doing, Senator?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
So to kick off this conversation, what is it like to get this grade separation bill passed in the Senate after having reintroduced this so many times before?
It feels great. You know, I think that we've been blocked just as bad as my community has been blocked by trains with this legislation in Lansing for 6 years. And I'm excited that we're finally getting to a solution where the House is going to take up this legislation soon. On the House side, our sponsor is Representative Jamie Churches. And together, I think that we'll be able to get this to the governor's desk and create a solution to fixing these railroad crossings in various parts of Michigan. But in particular, it's in the Metro Detroit region, specifically in Downriver in Wayne County. We have some of the longest trains that block traffic for extended periods of time, sometimes hours on end. And we know that with our solution here, it's going to take some time to build these bridges. But at least it gives us an option to create a pathway to solving the problem once and for all. And now that we have federal money on the table as well, we're at a point where people are paying attention to railroad crossings in a very significant way, not only in Michigan, but across the country. So I'm excited to do something about it.
Do you have any numbers that could present, like, you know, how long is someone in your district waiting on average, or how many emergency vehicles were delayed because of this?
Part of the problem is that because of federal regulations, we actually do not have data on these railroad crossings. And so for us, we've been requesting it for years, and the railroad companies just have refused to cooperate in that way. They cite national security concerns with tracking the type of product that's on their rail cars. And for us, we wanted to see, you know, at the very minimum, could we target these areas that have the highest concentration of blocked rail crossings with time? Because we did not have that, we only can rely on anecdotes. And so I can tell you that the day that my legislation passed out of committee, we had a railroad crossing in Woodhaven that was blocked for over an hour. And so we know we don't make these things up. We're talking anywhere from 30 minutes to 45 minutes to an hour. I've even had a case where a train was at a crossing in Trenton for over 4 hours, blocking workers getting to the Trenton engine plant. And so we have to rely on anecdotal data, but we know that with emergency response times, we've heard story after story from our ambulances and our fire and police and even our hospital staff that these are significant. They happen often, and we need to do something about it in order to save people's lives.
I thought that railroad companies were fined if their cars blocked traffic for more than 10 minutes.
They used to be fined. Yes. And that was actually in the 90s and early 2000s. There was a Supreme Court case U.S. Supreme Court case that I believe originated out of Michigan. The railroad company sued Plymouth City, and this case went all the way through the court system. And through that ruling, Interstate Commerce Clause was able to be utilized as the reason why we can no longer fine or regulate these railroad companies at the local level in any way at all. And so previously, yes, local communities would say, here's a $1,000 fine. Please move your rail cars after a certain amount of time. And they would either pay the fine or move the cars. And now there is no ability for local communities or even the state to have significant say over what regulation looks like. We are testing out some theories with some legislation in Transportation Committee right now to see how far can we push, whether it's a two-man crew or lengthening the train length or limiting the train length, excuse me. Those are ideas that we're hoping to pursue. But outside of that, the best and only solution here is to build bridges over or underneath the railroad.
You said most of the evidence is anecdotal. Do you have any reports from emergency responders of loss of life or issues that you could share with our reader or listeners?
Yes. So in committee, we had the president of the now Corwell Health System in Trenton, Wayne and Taylor, testify that she has had, dozens of families worry about this particular instance. In some of those cases, the patients were able to make it to the hospital, even though they had to get rerouted, and those patients survived. But in others, they've had instances where people have died. And the biggest fear that any hospital team will tell you is that they could not have done anything about it. And it was totally out of their control. And so even that 15-minute workaround to get outside of that construction zone or that that railroad crossing could have meant life or death. And then when I talk to my dispatchers, they will tell us instances where they have to find on a weekly basis, you know, a dozen cases where a train is blocking the route to that emergency service.
Why are these railroad cars sitting there for so long in the first place? I've been frustrated with that myself. I just sit there at these railroad tracks and just look at these trains. Why are they not moving?
So part of our challenge in Downriver is that at the end of my district, there are two of the largest rail yards for these companies in North America. So not just here in Michigan, but in the entire hemisphere. And what they're doing is they're loading and unloading products. Oftentimes it's car parts or cars themselves. And so that takes a lot of time to get everything on and off the train itself. And so we just happen to be in the unfortunate place where these rail yards were built a long, long time ago, prior to having significant population in the Downriver region. And now that our population has grown over the last few decades, Southern Wayne County is part of the fastest growing areas of Wayne County. We built new subdivisions. We had a lot more people who come here, a lot more businesses in Woodhaven, for example. And so now there's just a lot more traffic. And I've been in meetings where train companies have said to me directly and to all of my local leaders, we were here first. That's exactly what they said. They said, our rail lines were here first and you all built around us. And so you knew what you were getting into is what their argument is. That is so divorced from reality. Even though they've been very good partners with me on building our legislation for the rail grade separation.
Now, I know that your bill essentially creates a grant program for projects that would be overseen by MDOT. Now, what will be funding this grant program and how soon can we expect to see projects to kick off once this is signed into law?
I'm hopeful that during this budget process, we'll be able to put money into the fund itself. Which I think that we'll be in a position to do. We've got some of that money in the House version. We've got some rail grade separation money in the Senate version. So I'm hopeful we'll be able to start that process immediately. We know that there are at least 10 different rail crossings in southeastern Michigan that are problematic. Most of them are in my district, but there are a few in Oakland County, Monroe County. I think there's one in Detroit. And then there's others around the state as well. And so the way that we're hoping to build this fund is to prioritize the highest traffic, the most impactful areas across Michigan. Most of them are in the metro region. If we can put money into the fund, we have several of these projects that are already in motion, including one that's in Huron Township in Romulus that we'd hope to see accomplished in my district. I know there's one in Oakland County. I want to say Commerce Township has been a project that people have been looking at for a long time. And so we need to just be able to give communities a pathway to then have them start the grant process to even think that this is possible. The challenge is that local communities cannot afford these projects on their own. One of these bridges could cost as much as $30 to $35 million. In absence of a statewide grade separation fund, I've been able to work with folks like Senator Stephanie Chang. When she represented Woodhaven, we were able to secure money in the state budget, and then we leveraged that money and turned it into a project in Woodhaven. We are now ready to go out to bid finally for that project and start the rail grade separation in Woodhaven. We used that as a template where it was state money, federal money, county money, and city money all coming together to help fund this $35 million bridge. And so if we can do that again through my legislation, we'll create pathways for more of these collaborative efforts, especially with the federal infrastructure money coming from the Biden administration. We've got additional resources on the way.
Well, let's change gears here to the budget. Now, since you've been a chair, what's been the most surprising thing to you actually getting a chance to craft a budget like the pre-K through 12 budget?
So in the school budget, we have a significant surplus right now. And so I would say that the biggest challenge that I've seen is rectifying some of the situations that we've needed to rectify for a long time and just being able to do it. And so as the chair, deciding that we're going to give out the literacy money for Detroit Public Schools, $94.4 million, and just concurring on that and saying, yes, this is a priority, we're going to get it done. It's very humbling, to be very honest with you, but also very frustrating knowing that legislatures in the past had money and had resources and just chose not to act. And so we are rectifying situations. We are investing in education in an incredibly meaningful way and creating pathways for our public school system to be at more equitable funding. So being the chair of this committee and the lead negotiator for this committee has been really eye-opening just to know that with significant money, with budgets being reflections of our values, it really just showed in the last 4 years, the Republican legislature valued very different things than what most Michiganders value when it comes to their public schools, as well as what most people in the legislature really want to accomplish. So whether it's eliminating this debt for some school districts that have significant burdens with their debt, investing in the literacy money, really looking at at-risk money in a new and different way, we've got opportunities here to make transformational change for our students, and I'm really excited to lead that effort.
When your pre-K through 12 budget was being voted on the Senate floor a few weeks ago, a lot of Republicans were kind of criticizing the number of pet projects were in this budget. And I repetitively heard them criticize the East Point High School swimming pool. Why did you think it was important to create these kind of exclusive honeypots for very particular projects?
I wouldn't call them honeypots. I would call them key strategic investments in districts that need support from the state. Let's talk about East Point. East Point is a school district that used to be one of the largest in the region. Its high school was built for over 4,000 students. It's a historic, beautiful building. They had to shut down their pool many years ago due to lack of funding and due to lack of resources. They have been a school district that is an example of the terror of school choice policies and what it has done to communities like East Point. When school choice was first put in place, the idea was to empower families to be able to have a strong decision in how they want to educate their kids, send them to a different school district. The unintended consequence of that is that it has completely decimated Black and Brown districts across Michigan, where they are seeing schools choose different, families choose different places, and you're seeing that play out time and time again. East Point is one of those examples. In this high school that was built for 4,000 students, there are approximately 1,000 that go to this high school. And so you are at a capacity deficit. And so when we're thinking about ways that we can invest in our education system across Michigan, we're hoping to right some of these historic wrongs. And one of those ways is helping a school district put up a swimming program again to really bring hope and vitality back to a district that really is in need of it. And so we are looking at those types of efforts across the state. And when we had conversations on our school tour, I visited East Point. I saw the defunct pool. It needs to be reopened. Families don't have any public pool in the city of East Point because of other disastrous policies that we saw from the state that have decimated local government. And so if this is one area that the state can play a role in reopening a school program, allowing kids to be able to swim again and have a community that believes in itself again, I am more than willing to spend that money on it. And shame on Republicans for criticizing something that, quite honestly, they created with their DeVos-style education program.
What is your understanding on the budget? When are we going to expect to see a final product?
So we're hopeful to get targets by the end of this week, and then we'll be in earnest negotiating with our House and governor counterparts. I'll be leading the negotiation from the Senate side, and so we are in a position to hopefully be finished by mid-June. That would be an ideal goal, but if we can get it done by the end of June, I'd be happy.
In taking a look at the House K through 12 budget, your pre-K through 12 budget, and the governor's original recommendation, there isn't a heck of a lot of substantive difference among the three, is there?
We are rowing in the same direction.
Yeah.
I think that there are a couple of different programs that either might look differently than each other, or we might see different numbers of investment in those programs. One thing that I'm hoping to champion is a student loan forgiveness program, as you saw in my budget, for our educators, as well as expanded pre-K, which we saw in every version of the budget. And so we've just got to figure out how we can get to a final product that we're all happy with. But no matter what, we are going to be in a position where this is the strongest school budget we have ever seen. It's the most amount of investment we've ever seen in our students, and we're going to do transformational things with it.
Working on this appropriations subcommittee in the Senate, I mean, which Republican senator do you think is actually the most worthwhile negotiator?
So I've enjoyed my conversations with Republicans, because I think that in some of the programs that we're hoping to initiate, they also agree with us, whether it's full funding for special education, which is something that was a request of Senator Thomas Albert, or we're looking at an expanded preschool system. These are things that they also can get on board with. And so I don't see significant differences that would, one, block immediate effect, right? Or two, get them to even supporting this budget as a final product. When we were going into this negotiation, you know, I had never been consulted as a former educator by the Republicans in charge about what I'd like to see out of a budget. I was in the House, I was in the minority, and that was just never a process. I was never on appropriations, and so I was never included in that process. When I talked to some of my Democratic counterparts, that also seemed to be the case in a lot of different budgets, is that the concentration of power was so strong that it ended up being, you know, our minority vice chair for appropriations, as well as the appropriations chair, and not many other voices were included in that process. We did things differently. I not only took our committee out to the public, where we heard from members of the education community, staff and students alike, and parents as well, I also took a tour myself, and I went to Grand Rapids and East Point and Dearborn and places all over Michigan to hear from educators and the challenges that they're facing. That's a very different way of budgeting, and one that is way more inclusive and way more thoughtful when it comes to the priorities that we're hoping to bake into the budget. I also did the same thing with Republicans. I sent a letter and talked with my members on the subcommittee to ask them what their priorities were. And I already included several of those priorities. So yes, it was disappointing that they voted against it, but some of the things that they asked for were included in that budget. And so I think that there is a pathway here to get them on board. And I just think that we're a few conversations away from being able to do that.
Based on your responses today, can you talk about education policies beyond the appropriations process that you'd like to see enacted yet this year? Maybe school choice, maybe something else?
So I'm hopeful to do a couple of things. I have introduced a bill previously to create FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, as a requirement for graduation. Some states are doing this already because they see the significant amount of money that is left on the table from the federal government for our students, and we are missing out. Michigan students are missing out on $100 million every year from federal financial aid for post-secondary options, whether that's community college, a trade school, or a four-year university. We need to be in that position where our students are accessing those dollars and advancing their skill sets post-high school. So I'm gonna look at some legislation around that that I've previously introduced. I'm hoping to get across the finish line. I also wanna open up the books on our charter schools in Michigan. We need additional transparency. We have not seen a lot of discussion on that yet, but we're hopeful to be part of that process post-budget. So stay tuned. I think there will be a lot more to come.
When you say accountability, do you mean scaling back charter school options?
I don't think that we are in a position to do anything around reducing the amount of charter schools in Michigan. I think charter schools are here to stay. And I don't think you're going to see a lot of opposition from us trying to shut down charter schools. That is not where we're coming from. We're looking at how can you regulate the system that currently lacks regulation? How can you open up transparency and accountability for public tax dollars being utilized by private for-profit companies in some instances, and seeing a situation where we can create stability among our educators? We, as you saw in Detroit in the mid-2010s, we saw a charter school system that was wreaking havoc on the overall education landscape, where charter schools would open up in the same neighborhood as traditional public schools, or even as other charter schools, and create a situation that had way more seats than students available. And so I think there's a lot of work to still do in that space to rein in the system, not shutting anybody down, but finding ways to balance out the needs of the community, the needs of students and families, with the needs of protecting our public tax dollars.
Well, thank you so much, Senator Camilleri, for taking time to talk with us this morning, and good luck as you continue to work on your budget.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
To do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio in Okemos. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. And also special thanks to our guests this week, the Baldly Bipartisan Group of John Selleck and Adrian Hemond, and of course, Peter Riddell from the Honigman Law Firm and Senator Darren Camilleri. For the boss, John Roerink, and Samantha Schreiber, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.